This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details.
FUBAR Radio presents...
FUBAR Radio presents...
Politics on FUBAR.
Hello and welcome to Politics on FUBAR. It's Asa Bennett here and, today we're going to be talking about what's meant to be a very controversial topic, immigration, the I word. Yes. Now, if you listen to people like Nigel Farage, he'll say, you can't talk about immigration. They won't let you talk about it. You know, the establishment apparently want to silence you. But this is why on FUBAR we'll be happy to talk at great length, nonetheless. You know, you may see it talking about in Question Time, and Farage himself, a star of such a show, is happily banging on about Brussels, immigration, and all the rest of it. Nonetheless, it is a sort of theme, you know, that over the last few days, many more things have been seemingly unsayable. You know, at Glastonbury, you found Jeremy Corbyn sort of, he was talking to many crowds indeed, and among the crowds, there apparently was Channel 4's Jon Snow reportedly shouting, fuck the Tories, and he claims he has no recollection amid all this mania. But then, you know, with all the exhilaration that happened at the festival, perhaps what seized the most attention was Jeremy Corbyn's speech, and that he was thinking of immigration in that sense too, targeting people like Donald Trump, the President of the United States, with his travel ban that's now going its way through the Supreme Courts, and after his legal battles, he's now getting to form some sort of ban, at least. So he's a happy bunny, isn't he? But nonetheless, Corbyn wanted to have words of warning for him. He was saying that we should be building bridges, not walls, which obviously is a lovely line. You know, very good sort of anti-Trump sort of thing. But then, given the votes recently on the Commons on Brexit, I almost wonder, do people realise actually... The Jeremy Corbyn, he wants his own sort of hard Brexit that people might think means that free movement, for example, that mean that the EU right that allows so many people from across the continent to come to Britain freely, that he's wanting to pull that drawbridge up in some senses, because the Labour manifesto has a line in it saying free movement as we know it will end. And of course that implies that yes, he wants to respond to those worried about immigration. So in the same sense, Corbyn, while giving Trump a punch in the eye, figuratively speaking, rest assured, although some people might wish to otherwise. Instead, he wants to do his own sort of firming up at the borders, closing things down, making sure to sort of tighten sort of security. And so it's something that many people might feel. And indeed, with the vote that happened, Jeremy Corbyn actually is quite serious about this whole hard Brexit malarkey, by the way, because that's why when there was the vote on the sort of Queen's speech with various amendments put forward by Labour MPs, one from Chucker among us, saying inviting MPs to bind Britain into the single market, which would force it to accept free movement into continuation, and also the customs union, which would also mean that it couldn't necessarily do sort of trade deals as much as it would like, and this is something that you can only be a member of if you are still part of the EU with all that comes with it. Corbyn didn't take that lightly, no. Instead, though, there have been quite a few sort of sackings now of ministers who dare defy the whip, or in Labour's case, politely being asked to abstain on these amendments. You know, they backed it, they wanted to stay in the single market, and oops, they are no longer on the team now. So he is very serious about this whole sort of clamping down immigration in a fair, and his words, in a fair and managed sense. And at the same point, Theresa May, she was trying to extend a hand towards EU migrants to show that she's been very friendly and that she is not going to pull up the drawbridge, telling sort of people during the Brexit negotiations that actually she will offer a generous offer that means that if they've arrived before Article 50 was invoked, they can stay, they're fine, they're settled. Obviously, it remains to be seen if that remains the case for those who arrived during the Brexit negotiations. The EU would like it to the cut-off date for sort of safe livelihoods to be after Britain leaves in March 2019. Theresa May wants it all up in the air in a sense. She wants to have it maybe earlier. Obviously, it'll be under Britain's control in her view. So we will have to see. I mean, the one thing with the Brexit negotiations is that the EU, they've said that they will, you know, they're trying to talk kind words as well in exchange, saying that they're minded to reciprocate the offer in generosity. But we don't know yet, because the details in Brussels negotiations, the Brexit mantra to remember is that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. So while Theresa May might be being kind, some people might be saying not enough towards migrants and with the rights and being fast enough to help them resettle here, with suggestions they might have to have their own sort of ID cards and papers in order to work, and settle. They'd like it to be sort of faster, perhaps. But then, you know, this may all be jeopardised as we go down the line. So in months to come, who knows what may get thrown up in the air and might sort of derail things. And so to explore immigration and all the associated sort of issues that spring forth from it, we'll be having an extended interview later in the show with the Conservative MEP, David Campbell-Bannerman. And he also understands, in a sense, reason why people might be worried about immigration, particularly because he's got a rare distinction of being someone who left the Conservatives for UKIP and then came back. So he's seen it, he's met Nigel Farage and all that, he's disgusted, and he's back in the sort of centre-right, you might think. So I'll be curious to see what he has to say. And after that, we'll be debating this week's question of, is immigration a problem in Britain, and why? Now, if you're listening to all this thinking, my God, you know, he's just rabbiting on of all these things, making really naff Nigel Farage impressions, I have to sort of set him straight, by all means, do tweet me at FUBAR Radio or email politics@fubarradio.com. And so, coming up next, I'll be reviewing this week's headlines with Flora Carr. And we'll be speaking to her, though, after this short break.
FUBAR Radio presents
Background Show with Noel Clark and Johanna James.
Emma Watson said that acting categories shouldn't be separated between men and women. There should just be best actor and then best supporting actor. You know, a man or woman should be able to get that. Here's the issue. Currently, for every one role that a woman gets, 7 men get a role. So if you suddenly take away 2 awards, surely you're narrowing the odds of women winning awards. You know, it's fine for her because she has millions of dollars. She's got her award. She's up there winning awards. I don't want women to be frozen out.
Every Friday.
Background Show with Noel Clark and Johanna James.
From 4 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
No. Very much welcome back. We've got the journalist Flora Carr in the studio, sort of for the week in review. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Now, what was interesting you today among the many headlines we have?
I think the Trump travel ban is really interesting. It comes into effect now for 6 countries.
Which ones?
Iran, Libya, Syria, Somalia, Sudan and Yemen. Mm. So all mainly Muslim countries. And it's resulted in quite a lot of controversy. Talks about how it's going to incite further Islamophobia, how it's very sort of un-American, unconstitutional. And actually, David Miliband just weighed in on the ban and has said that it will negatively affect a lot of innocent people.
Yes.
Which I do agree with.
Oh, completely. But obviously for Trump, he doesn't really care about that. He embraces the controversy because in his opinion, it's just going to be great. We need to do this, you know, to claim our borders. It's the Trump. I mean, it's his people who wanted him to get tough on immigration. So he's probably quite delighted.
Of course, it is a big triumph for him and for his administration. But definitely not for the rest of the world.
Down so many times by the courts, and you know this is the characteristic of his leadership, no, isn't it? That he's just trying to troll everyone else. You know,
definitely, I think it was revised in March following several legal issues. So now this sort of smaller, much more nuanced version will be coming into effect.
But he'll pretend it's still great. It's still the biggest.
Oh, of course.
Bet.
I'm sure he's tweeting right now.
Oh, my days, yes. Because we're given all the characteristic stuff he's been saying about sort of, the presenters and bleeding from facelifts and, oh, awful things. You know, he's obsessed with just personal attacks anyway. Disgusting. But no, I'm clearly just trying to make him tweet about the show. I mean, obviously, POTUS, if you are.
Well, that would be great.
Yeah, this is just totally sad. The loser Bennett. I don't know what he's doing. But no, enough about that. So let's talk about less Trumpish things. Because, you know, more serious
matters.
Yeah,
thank God.
Yeah. So I see that you've got a story about teachers at every school in the country now will receive special training in mental health issues.
Yes. So this is a story that over the next 3 years, 3,000 school staff will be given specialist mental health training. Hmm. And this, of course, comes after Bryony Gordon for The Telegraph, her interview with Prince Harry, and the sort of increased interest in the mental health issue. So that I think that's brilliant, and I've been talking to friends who are training to be teachers, and they're all very pro this legislation.
Okay, because then I mean, would it cost a lot then in that sense? I mean, people say you should be throwing more money at these things, and actually it's interesting because sort of the Democratic Unionist Party, this sort of deal that went on, the £1 billion pound bong, you might call it, they actually highlighted something fascinating which made me sort of a pause for thought, which is that I think it's 500 million of it is going towards mental health services in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And they have among the highest suicide rates there, in a sense. So actually, you know, it's sort of curious. When we talk about sort of mental health issues, people sort of, at least there are moments like this where we do think, you know, well, amid the kind of hung parliament shenanigans and all that, it's good that there's action being done, in a sense. You know, when money is the one thing that would sort of be needed for this plan, it's good that other people are benefiting in other ways already, in a sense, you know.
I think this will be excellent for Theresa May's profile. Yes. She is sort of hanging by a thread at the minute in terms of sort of public scrutiny over many issues. And I think what she said about this legislation is that it will sort of help end the stigma. And I think it is so high on sort of on everyone's agenda at the minute. The media's, the public's, that I think she'd be foolish not to jump on this.
She said it's one of those burning injustices, mental health, that she wants to really sort of tackle. And well, was it the parity of esteem, I think the phrase is. So that the government really is taking it seriously. And now we find, I mean, it's sort of tragic in some senses, because now the mental health agenda risks being sort of thrown out the window just because she has to obsess about Brexit.
I don't think it will. I think as I say it, it is very high on the agenda for everyone. I really hope it isn't.
Well, of course not. I mean, obviously I would hope similarly. You know, it's important given these sort of things that you can remain high. And let's be charitable for a second. That as much as I'm saying, oh no, the government has to obsess about Brexit, that, you know, it's. They're not so one-track minded. They can think about other things too. They can think about, you know, so the services in Northern Ireland, services in England now, hopefully will come with that too. And, you know, because given there's a lot of social progress over the last few weeks, actually, given that. Given that, I think Stella Creasy had that amendment for sort of allowing women to have, coming from Northern Ireland, to have abortions in England.
It was interesting you mentioned Northern Ireland. This is the news that following Stella Creasy's amendment, the Tories have now done a U-turn on their policy not to give Northern Irish women free access to NHS abortions. And so you were talking about cost. This will cost, I think, an estimated $1 million a year. But I think, again, it's an incredible thing and a real triumph for not only Stella Creasy, but abortion campaigners, and Northern Irish women.
I mean, it's curious that, because for a Labour MP, you know, you're a backbencher in that sense, to sort of be able to put policy in like that, just get it into the government.
It really does show the power of the backbenchers following the hung parliament.
And the weakness of the government.
Yeah.
It sort of seems to be, if you can persuade a few Tory MPs that you're on the right, in a sense, that's fine. You got a policy. Well done. You know, it's all power to Stella and everyone else.
Yeah, well, that wasn't the case with the
Chakaramana's amendment, was it?
No.
Yeah.
That's
more factional, though. Whereas this one, sort of, you know, this one's that sort of thing of
this
would
one
you like,
pulls at the heartstrings.
Yes, because it's the best defense people can sort of say some slightly weird, you know, let's not interfere in Northern Irish, you know, politics. Oh, you know, don't want to try and like sort of undercut them in services. If they ban it over there, we can't start offering these things over here. It's very that sounds very sort of nitpicking, and I can imagine that's why they would worry about it and not stand in the way too much.
Well, the DUP themselves did not stand in the way of this. I think what they said was that
we have our money, we're going off to the bank now.
We have our money, and also this is a case for NHS England to deal with.
No, that was one of those curious things, because at the same point with the government, I mean, do you think the sort of, are you reassured by how the Brexit negotiations are going then? It's
as a young person, or
well, as a young person, definitely sort of in many senses.
I think obviously it's worrying that a government that's having to be propped up by the DUP is sort of paving the way for this Brexit. We don't really... Theresa May has really shot herself in the foot, hasn't she? In so many ways.
I mean, how's your process been? I mean, since last June... Because obviously it's only been about a year since Britain voted to leave the European Union. I imagine you're pretty distraught the day after. Let's put it this way. Tell me about your process of thinking as the months have gone on, in a sense. How have you evolved in thinking, okay, we voted. God, this is a great unknown. And then maybe you thought, okay, Conservative majority, at least she knows what she's doing. Oh, what the hell is this?
Yeah. It's interesting. I helped the Observer New Review on their sort of big spread on first-time voters in the run-up to the election. And I spoke to many, many young people about how they felt about the upcoming election. And it was interesting. This was done at the beginning of the election campaign, and a lot of people, whether or not they were sort of 18 or 24, they or no matter what their voting sort of preferences were, they were sort of positive towards Theresa May, in that she seemed a stable pair of hands. And of course that completely overturned by the end of the campaign. And it seems bizarre that at the beginning of this election campaign, everything was based on Theresa May as a strong and stable personality, and now that's completely overturned and changed.
And now we just sort of think, God, she's running through wheat fields, and she's always... it's kind of every vote by vote. That's how she's surviving these days.
And going back to your question, that definitely makes me feel more nervous about the Brexit negotiations, and I'm sure people across the country are feeling the same way.
I mean, do you remember Andrea Leadsom on Newsnight the other night saying that we should be all more patriotic about these things?
Oh,
you know,
God,
sort of,
yeah.
I mean, well, how did you feel about that? Should we not be getting the bunting out and saying, come on, Britain, let's...
It's rather Soviet era, wasn't it? Yeah.
One versus 27, we can have them. Yeah. Sort of, this is clearly how negotiations tend to go.
Bizarre, ridiculous, and frankly rather
David
scary.
Davis mud wrestling with Michel Barnier. Sort of,
what an image.
I mean, let me just to get away from the lurid and onto the more sort of genuinely serious matters. Because you picked out another story, which, given we're talking about Theresa May, a former Home Secretary, she knows, you know, everything to the Home Office. She should be seeing these things. It seems that the Home Office has got in a bit of a spot of bother now, because The Guardian reports that immigration detainees have brought a legal challenge against £1 an hour slave wages.
Yes, this was a little story that I picked up about how, 10 people who've been detained in UK immigration centres have launched this legal challenge against Home Office for paying them just £1 an hour in wages. Now, if you bear in mind that the national minimum wage outside of London is £7.50 an hour, detainees who are not prisoners, they haven't committed any crimes, they're being paid £1 an hour by the Home Office for very menial jobs, so for example toilet cleaning. On the one hand, these jobs are optional, they're not mandatory, they sign up to do them. So that's the argument that the Home Office is presenting, but then on the other hand, the detainees are arguing that the food at the centre is inedible. They need this money in order to provide some basic food because they're given something like 70p a day whilst in the detention centre to live off. And they're saying that that's just not enough.
I can imagine. It's sort of and yet where do they go after that, in a sense? Because it's not like they can sort of just go on the job market again and find something else, in a sense. They're almost stuck with it.
No, and they are stuck in these detention centres, so they don't really have any choice.
No, it's so sad with that, because I imagine they don't get sort of the living wage or anything anyway. They don't qualify for sort of... The government can say, oh, personal tax allowance.
No, they don't qualify for this... minimum wage. So that means that they're getting less than a seventh of the national minimum wage.
That is shocking. My word. Well, in that case, in the time we have, then do you have any other stories you wish to highlight, though? Sort of on Brexit, or sort of how politics is going now, in that
how
sense?
How politics is going now?
Did you enjoy the Glastonbury speech?
From the token millennial. Oh.
Yeah.
With
it's not the token millennial, far from it. I mean, you know, obviously, I'm very much woke as well. Now, but in seriousness, sort of, were you there?
Yes, I wasn't there, unfortunately. I would dearly love to go to Glastonbury. But, I think everyone in the country watched Corbyn make that speech, and it was definitely very rousing. And we heard where he got his inspiration for the many, not the few. What was the poem? Was it Shelley?
Yeah, Shelley. Yes. He likes to say we are lions, we rise.
Yes. Sort of, that was it.
Undefeatable. Yeah, oh, it's feisty.
Stirring stuff.
Yes, I mean, I'm actually told by sort of my esteemed producer that it's actually maybe sort of Percy Shelley. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because so actually we know our poetry now, don't worry. We'll do a recital maybe another time, perhaps. Sort of because.
Yeah.
I think clearly with Glasgow, did you find it quite funny as well, the Jon Snow thing, when he was claimed to have said, you know, fuck the Tories, and then someone on Channel 4 last night saying, not everyone hates the Tories as much as you do, Jon, and he was just getting quite cross. I mean, perhaps it's that kind of awful hangover you might get after a festival. He was, you know, maybe so grouchy to be reminded of what he got up to.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake to... Maybe he was talking to the sort of young people at Glastonbury, but I think it is a mistake to assume that all young people voted Labour.
Basically, just don't pander. That's the lesson we now have. Yeah. You know, if you want to get on, just don't still go around saying, oh, yeah.
The objective.
Yeah, exactly. That's the lesson
that's
for us
journalism,
all.
Journalism, yeah.
Quite right. And I think on that moment of consensus, I think we should probably wrap up. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And so, you know, coming up next, well, I'd just like to play a little sort of package, actually, sort of on sort of Donald Trump and what he's been up to with the Supreme Court wrangling that we've had over the last few days.
We must immediately suspend immigration from any nation that has been compromised by terrorism until such time as proven vetting mechanisms have been put in place. We don't want them in our country. I only want to admit individuals into our country who will support our values and love our people. Anyone who endorses violence, hatred, or oppression is not welcome in our country and never, ever will be.
I'm establishing new vetting measures to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States of America. We don't want them here. We want to ensure that we are not admitting into our country the very threats our soldiers are fighting overseas. I am privileged to be here with you, and I promise that our administration will always have your back. We will always be with you.
And now, welcome back to the show. It's Asa Bennett still here, and I have the pleasure to have Sean Kemp on the line, former special advisor to Nick Clegg. Hello.
Hello.
Now, first off, I'd like to apologise for playing a Donald Trump clip in advance. I'm not trying to compare you to him. I'm just, you know, sort of keeping listeners updated on what's been happening. Sort of, you know, although I imagine you obviously, you know, what we're about to have, our discussion will be just as great, like totally great anyway. So, nonetheless. Yeah. Sort of this week we're focusing on immigration and sort of xenophobia, right-wing attitudes in a sense. And you've seen, well, recent history, there's, you know, UKIP 2013 terrifying the Tories, and now they've died away in a sense. It all seems to have gone towards the mainstreams of Labour Party and Conservatives. And Liberal Democrats now, they're the only real party, it seems, actually being open to refugees and open to immigration in a sense, willing to bang that drum.
Yeah, and you can see how the colossal amount of electoral success that brings. again, I remember even in 2010 when I was head of media for Lib Dems and sort of at the height of Cleggmania, which sounds like I'm describing a fictional world now, I know. But even at that point, what really, during the general election where briefly we were ahead in the polls, what actually sort of really hurt the Liberal Democrats was our immigration policy, was the fact we had an open immigration policy, that we'd proposed an amnesty for illegal immigrants who'd been here for sort of 10 years and so on. And the moment you are seen as championing those causes politically, it's absolute poison, frankly, in large swathes of the country. And that's what I think...
Because everyone comes after you then, even though Boris Johnson proposed amnesty as well, I seem to recall. Yeah.
You've just painted a very big target on yourself. The other two parties really hammer the message home, and they really hammer it home in the national media and so on, but where it really comes across is actually on the doorstep. You know, your canvassers and your will just come back all the time and just say, all we are hearing about is people raising immigration as a policy issue. And in 2010, it absolutely clobbered the Lib Dems. And really, since then, yes, the Lib Dems have continued to be that party that talks about that, but there's a reason why Labour and the Tories don't talk about immigration in those terms, and it's not because they don't see some of the economic reasons for why, for example, an amnesty might be a sensible policy, but that they know that politically it would just be a sort of cataclysmic disaster for them to do it.
Oh, that's interesting, because I remember drawing on your time as part of during the coalition years, there must have been lots of friction on the issue, given that only the other day, George Osborne, the new editor of the Evening Standard, claimed that Theresa May had sort of overruled the cabinet when they wanted to, when David Cameron and George Osborne wanted to have a extend the hand of friendship towards EU migrants, and she was putting her foot down. So, I mean, during the Liberal Democrat years, when they were in the corridors of power, that must have been even more fractious.
It was an absolute nightmare, and all from the Home Office, quite frankly. And there were two main issues. One was the pledge for to keep immigration down, net immigration down to the tens of thousands, which was a Conservative Party promise in the manifesto. In the coalition agreement, we'd kind of watered it down so that it wasn't a promise.
Mm.
And there was this constant back and forth, and a really tedious sort of sick of it type arguments that I would have with press officers and so on, removing specific wording about that pledge. That went on for years.
Mm.
Just that ins and outs of, do we actually, tens of thousands, that's not a government policy, and they were trying to sort of sneak it back in. It was absurd. But the big, more meaty issue was about policies, like you said, about trying to be more, and a more open country, and things like encouraging not just EU immigration, like students coming over from India, for example, the amount of people who are needed to work in the science sector, for example, where the rows between the business and department and the Treasury and the Home Office about what the immigration policy should be was kind of one of the long sort of running sores of coalition all the way through those 5 years. And not necessarily just Lib Dem v Tory, it would be more Lib Dems and sort of Tories in favour of that kind of more open borders, more sort of business-friendly attitude, and Theresa May and people who just wants a much more hardline immigration policy. That ran all the way through. It's probably the most.
But then you're talking about the rows. Although I remember there was one policy that did sort of escape completely, clearly and hard to forget in a sense, which was the go home vans when the Home Office sent them round.
Yes.
And Jeremy Brown, I think, was a Lib Dem minister there. So what? Why did you guys let that happen?
That was a question we all asked ourselves when we saw the pictures of them. I never got to the bottom of what happened with the immigration vans, I'll be honest, despite having launched a furious quest. We definitely didn't know them. I was working in number 10, but I was part of sort of Nick Clegg's team. We certainly weren't aware of them until we sort of literally saw the photos in the media. I'm not sure if Jeremy Brown signed it off or if it just never crossed his desk. It wouldn't surprise me if it never crossed his desk.
So they sort of kept it to themselves, yeah.
Yeah, the Home Office then was run. I mean, a lot of the things that people read about how Theresa May and then sort of her two chief aides as well, as like Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, like how they ran Downing Street, like a lot of centralised control, no one else knew anything. That was pretty much how the Home Office was run as well. So, I, you know, it was one of those ones that just kind of completely blindsided us. And that's one of the problems with sort of being in coalition is that that things can happen that you're not aware of, and you sort of got the blame for them. But I never really got to the bottom of how that happened. There was such a huge controversy about it. We sort of kicked off, and then they were swiftly sort of removed. But that sort of stance, that sort of attitude, that was how Theresa May. That was her whole approach. Immigration was the number one issue for her.
I mean, do you think that's indicative of her style of leadership in a sense? She'd do something, you know, maybe unplanned, atrocious, that she'd only have considered with Nick Timothy. People would then laugh at her, and then she would draw back on it, like the social care sort of attempt.
I would say that the vans are different to the social care attempt. I think there is similarity in the style of a very small group of people making decisions. What I would say is the difference is that the vans, I thought, were terrible and sent an awful message. I'm not sure politically, in the sense of appealing to a large swathe of the country, they probably have gone down quite well, frankly.
I suspect if you
polled them, those vans saying, if you're here illegally or whatever, you know, go home. I think they would have gone down quite well in a kind of, you know, if you'd suggested doing that during a general election, I suspect you had a poll bounce. Whilst the social care policy was more actually politically, it was a vote loser.
Yeah, no, they're attacking their base, definitely. But
you're right, it's about the style of government and how she ran things. I think it was indicative.
Because at the same point, with her tone on immigration, I mean, I know that Vince Cable, he fought the good fight for open liberal Britain in the business department. And yet, so Theresa May later, she had this habit of building up of whenever she'd go to Conservative conference, she'd make sort of speeches that I remember Rachel Johnson described one as sort of sounding like it came out of the National Front or something. And that sort of, you know, that thing about citizens of nowhere. And then global citizens, oh, God, we're going to get rid of them. And Amber Rudd now saying, oh, we're going to, well, previously saying we're going to have businesses do lists of immigrants, draw up lists of immigrants. Yeah. I mean, wow. What was, like, you didn't stop, but you clearly didn't sort of like get to see the light then. You know, that sort of working together sort of didn't change her.
No, and they know, in the Conservative Party as well, they know immigration is a big political issue. There are votes in sounding tough on immigration. And I thought the Amber Rudd one was interesting, that we'll have sort of lists of businesses, we'll have to keep lists, because you know that's not really her politics, actually. She's actually a more kind of open borders type politician. And it sounded like her just desperately trying to sound like she was tough. And then weirdly getting the tone wrong, so sort of everyone went, hang on, this sounds absolutely appalling. Theresa May, when she was a Home Secretary and then Prime, she was an interesting one because she was very tough on immigration, and particularly illegal immigration, but then she would balance it a lot of the times with, for example, what she would say to the police about their stop and search powers, for example, where she would say quite tough things to them about that. So she was quite, I'm going to say quite skillful, and that sort of implies a level of calculation. It might mean that just generally what she believed as well. But she managed to balance it quite well. But when she talked about immigration, even though she'd say things sometimes that I strongly disagreed with, you kind of got the sense that that was actually what she believed. Amber Rudd, I think, is interesting as Home Secretary because I'm not sure she quite believed it. And that's where I think sometimes when she missteps in immigration, it's because she's trying to sound sort of tougher than she is. It's kind of a sort of a pretend toughness, I think, with her.
I mean, did you work with her at all privately? Did you hear about her and the grapevine?
Theresa May?
Amber Rudd.
Amber Rudd, all you hear about Amber Rudd is that she's considered to be, well, from with my sort of Liberal Democrat perspective, she's one of the ones that sort of say, oh, she's one of the, like, the, she's one of the better, the nicer ones, like, more open borders.
Yeah, they keep making her say all these awful, ghastly things. So clearly, she doesn't have a backbone to stand up to number 10 with.
Well, I just think she knows the way the political wind is blowing, to be honest, and it's not. It never sounds pleasant when you describe politicians like that. But the fact is, all politics is about compromise.
Well, if I could ask you about someone who doesn't sort of compromise in that case, or a final question, Sir Vince Cable, you know, it seems that the heir apparent to the Liberal Democrat leadership, you know, are you delighted that he's just going to be anointed?
Well, I would have wanted Jo Swinson as leader. I thought Jo's great. I thought she could have done it better if she'd wanted to. She decided not. It's a shame. I think for what the Lib Dems need, look, what Vince Cable does bring is he's a known face, he's a known voice. The really tough thing when you've got a few MPs, Lib Dems, is just getting anyone to notice you, quite frankly. I mean, it's like, forget about the nuances of policy positions and whatnot. Can you get on telly and do people know who you are? At least Vince brings that. He can sort of ensure that the Lib Dems don't get completely drowned out over the next couple of years, because the really interesting stuff isn't going on with the Lib Dems. The really interesting stuff is in the Conservative and Labour Party. So someone who is at least a sort of, people know who he is and he's a recognisable figure.
That nice man who danced on the telly.
Yeah, exactly. I think it brings some advantages like that. I think some of the bigger problems that Lib Dems about who they actually are. There are some sort of existential questions for Lib Dems about actually what kind of party are they? Who are their core voters? You know, when everyone's talking, a lot of people talking at the moment about how much they'd like to see a centrist party, and they never for one moment go, oh, hang on, we could just sort of join the Lib Dems.
You could just vote Liberal Democrat,
So when people aren't even thinking like that way about the party, there's some really big issues that have got to be gripped with. And I think that's probably going to be a much longer-term project than how we actually shape the party that it's something that people see as a tenable sort of centrist party. Because at the moment, I'm not sure they do, if I'm blunt.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, at least Sir Vince will be able to sort of take it on and perhaps hand it over to Jo Swinson at a later time.
I suspect that's the plan. Well, they're vehemently denying it, but I strongly suspect that's the plan.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing, you know, if you're right in that case. So thank you so much for your time, Sean.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Bye now. And so that was Sean Kemp, the former special advisor to Nick Clegg, and so a man who's seen things from the coalition and he lives to tell the tales. Now, if you've been listening to all this and thinking you may actually want to sort of tweet more, by all means do, as at FUBAR Radio, because we've got a poll going where we're keen to find out your thoughts on, is immigration a problem in Britain? You know, what do you think? And actually, many of you so far, the majority, have been saying, no, actually, it's vital to society. And a good fraction, sort of perhaps otherwise saying that there are bigger issues. No one yet has said, actually, yes, and we should build a wall, and yet again, sort of, look, any of you out there who think that actually, no, it's a sort of Darwinian survival of the fittest? If so, that answer is no one's picking that yet. But so, it's sort of, you know, very much getting an interesting sense of your views as we're going on through the show. And so, coming up, we'll have next a proper studio debate, sort of, you know, to-ing and fro-ing galore. We'll be joined in the studio by Carl Sharrow, the architect, satirist and Middle East commentator, and Sundar Katwala, the director of British Future. But first, in case you missed Jeremy Corbyn's speech at Glasgow, here he is speaking rather passionately and conveniently about walls.
Look on the wall right over there that surrounds this wonderful festival. And there's a message on that wall for President Donald Trump. And you know what it says? Build bridges, not walls. Let's stop the denigration of refugees, people looking for a place of safety in a cruel and dangerous world. They are all they are all human beings, just like all of us here today, looking for a place of safety and looking to make their contribution to the future of all of us. Racism in any form divides, weakens, and denies us the skills and brilliance of people who are being discriminated against, in just the same way that sexism does, be it in lower pay for women, less opportunities for women, or less aspirations. Thank you very much, Glastonbury. Thank you for inviting me here today. I'm proud to be here. Thank you very much, Glastonbury.
Yes, that was Jeremy Corbyn's Glasgow speech. You know, if you are all sort of cheering right now, then you will be even more excited, actually, because we're going to have more of a debate on immigration. And now I've got Sundar Katwala from British Future in the studio. Hello. And Carl Sharrow, the commentator, satirist, and general raconteur. Anyway, so thank you very much for your time, gentlemen. But so first off, I just wondered to Carl, recently, the immigration debate has been sort of thrust into the open by Europe's struggle to deal with refugees, this sort of migration crisis, in that sense. I mean, do you feel that sort of Britain handled this well, in a sense?
I think, historically, Britain has handled immigration quite well. And in recent years, I think, you know, I feel I'm an immigrant myself. I feel very welcome over here. I've made a life for myself. I think where the failure has come historically in the politicians and elites standing up for immigration and then, you know, alleviating the concerns of people who felt maybe competition or who were marginalized in one way or another because of immigration. So I think the problem really has been the lack of willingness to talk about it openly and stand up for it and defend it and kind of create policies that might ameliorate any negative impact that it has.
But it was left of Germany to lead the way on this. So Britain kind of twiddled its thumbs.
Yeah. I think I'm not convinced of the narrative out there that sort of Germany took a moral stand and leadership on the position. I think it was quite a pragmatic decision by Angela Merkel that was done in a highly undemocratic manner, much like a lot of her decisions. And I don't think that's necessarily it did work out under the circumstances, but that's not necessarily the way policies like that should be handled. There should be more debate and there should be more engagement, and ultimately the decisions need to be taken on a democratic basis. Otherwise, we're storing problems up for the future. And if we kind of try to avoid it or resolve it in a knee-jerk way, undemocratically. So I think, yes, at the moment when particularly the Syrian refugee crisis was intensified, Britain seemed to be quite defensive and kind of narrow-minded to a certain extent. We didn't even let small unaccompanied children come into Britain. So we came across as mean-spirited, which doesn't reflect, you know, the last 15, 20 years what's been happening in this country and the openness of this country. So yes, there was a setback, but all the more reason to re-engage with the topic and kind of try to defend. We've made a wonderful thing here in Britain. It's a diverse, multicultural, open society, and we need to stand up for that.
But then, Sundar, do you agree? I mean, do you think we were mean-spirited? Or perhaps you understand why there was this sort of anxiousness just to echo Merkel and, you know, throw the gates open to them?
I think if you ask why didn't Britain do more, there was quite a lot of empathy. People saw the case of Alion Kurdi in particular, and so quite a lot of people wanted to do more. Other people felt quite anxious and conflicted about whether we could, and that's because of the broader debate we're having about immigration in Britain. And I think people have quite a strong sense that immigration has been part of this country over the generations, over the decades. Where we've got a problem more recently is that the public have lost confidence in how their governments handle that, partly because the Labour governments were perceived, I think correctly, not to have expected the large-scale European migration we got after 2004 from Poland and other countries, therefore not to prepare, not to plan for it. We then got a Conservative government that said, well, that is too high, we agree with you completely, that will be coming right down. And, you know, every quarter for 7 years that doesn't happen. So a broken promise to really crack down on it just again tells you the government's not got a grip. And so that is a big part of Brexit. I think people make quite a big distinction between actually a lot of frustration and anxiety about governments dropping the ball and the people they know and they meet. And we know that, you know, the people who meet or know immigrants or live in places with more immigration, you know, in London or Manchester, were much keener to stand the European Union, were not voting on immigration. It's their lived experience. Mm. But in places where there had been very fast change and people thought the government hadn't got a grip on it, which Boston, Lincolnshire becomes the typical example, people just feel it wasn't handled well. So there's great empathy, I think, towards Syrians on television. You think they could be my children. Mm. But you need a government to say, this is how we handle it. Yeah. Here's the plan for the local impact. And, you know, a much more local response, actually, to the contact you want people who come into this country to have with the people they're joining to live with.
Because it does seem also in the public policy debate in Britain that the conservative-minded folk, they sort of say, well, we should listen to people's concerns on immigration. And then anyone who's sort of liberal then gets sort of shouted down, saying, again, you need to listen to their concerns. You know, but then that's easy to say. But then what really should a centrist and moderate response be, in a sense?
I think it actually has to start with actually having the confidence to go and talk and listen to people and think you can do it. Some very interesting evidence this week in the British social attitudes that shows that every country is polarised between, you know, if you're a young liberal graduate who lives in a big city, you like immigration. If you left school without qualifications 50 years ago, you feel that the change has been too fast. But Britain has that polarisation more strongly than anybody else, and I think Brexit has really reinforced that. So we're going to have those debates in a very polarised way. But I'm also interested in who bridges that gap. How do you actually have the conversation? Actually, although that's a sort of immigration is good economically and culturally, or I'm really worried about it debate, people with those views actually agree on quite a lot about what makes immigration work. People do need to speak the language. We should support that. Integration and contact's good. Contribution is good. One thing we've been doing at the moment is something called the National Conversation on Immigration. We're going to 60 towns and cities and having a, not what gets your goat up about this, but what should we do next? And there's a lot more consensus, actually, in many ways on what we do next, that we protect the Europeans who are here. We continue to welcome skills. We would like more control over the choices of how many low and semi-skilled workers can come in at once, in particular ways, what is business doing about training that goes with that. So actually people can agree on policy, even though they're culturally different ends of this, my country's changing too fast, or, you know, like, let's get on with it, it's the modern world now.
So do you think then, Carl, that with Brexit, that this is a sign that Britain's going to become more splintered, or can we actually sort of have a reassessment of what it means to sort of look outwards towards the world and actually rationalise things?
I think I'm absolutely one of those that think, you know, whether you voted Remain or Leave, we are in this position now and we have to be quite positive about how we shape our future as a country. And a big part of that is our attitude to countries abroad and our attitude to immigration, our attitude to the movement of labor. And then you could look at some kind of the fog around the debate now when, for example, a principle like freedom of movement is discussed. We don't actually have a universal freedom of movement. We have freedom of movement within the EU, which tends to kind of disadvantage, let's say, immigrants from or laborers that want to come from other countries in the world. And we've got to say now, I think those of us at least of a more progressive mindset, is this is the opportunity to kind of create a more open policy rather than withdrawing and closing down the borders. We should kind of encourage this relationship that historically we have, you know, with India, with Pakistan, with China, with other countries in the world, and kind of try to create a more effective, enlightened immigration policy, but not to kind of treat the Brexit as if it's the end and we need to now close down the walls, because the debate is only just starting. The debate about what the future of Britain will be is literally just starting now. Now, it needs to happen in a political way. So there needs to be a political program, because it's linked to the economic models that we're going to employ. It's linked to all manners of policy aspect. That's why it needs to be conducted in a political manner, and we need to see visions, positive visions about what Britain would be.
And there are visions already emerging, yet it seems that Brexit, for some people, at least on the right, seems to mean that we can sort of turn into Australia, the sort of stop the boats, Tony Abbott stuff, send them to Cambodia, you know, let's really vet everyone. There are dangers, in a sense, along... opportunities.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There are very big dangers, and this is why I think the responsibility is on us now to kind of provide a rebuttal in the form of a positive vision of how we shape that. We kind of celebrate not just at a rhetorical level the role of immigrants, but in terms of all aspects of all their contributions, but also how much of an impact they will make going forward to the future. So I'll give you an example. I work at an architecture practice, and if we had to kind of close down the walls and not able to recruit people from abroad, our business will suffer hugely. And there's two aspects to that. There's the aspect of training, you know, the local population, but there's also there's this dynamism of having, you know, the best talents out there come and contribute to economy. That is a positive thing. And so the rebuttal for me is not to kind of turn this into just a moral debate where we are the good guys and the people, the other side wants to close down the borders because no, that's not how it should be contacted.
And I
don't think that's necessarily, I think the danger, and Theresa May in particular wanted to kind of turn the Brexit vote into almost like a referendum on immigration, which it wasn't. And I think that was quite disingenuous. And I think now is a moment to correct that and say, the question on the ballot wasn't do you favor immigration or not. It was about membership of the European Union. So let's not all assume that this was a referendum on immigration and we're going to have to stop immigration now. No, now we have a bigger challenge in terms of making this positive case, but also it's a case about putting forward a very positive future for Britain.
Because you're right, actually, there are people on the Brexit side, the sort of Daniel Hannan and folk, who do sort of say this means we can embrace the Commonwealth, we can actually, if necessary, have greater immigration, but it's on our terms, crucially. But then, Sundar, what's intriguing, though, is that as soon as I say that, you know, people on the other sort of corners of the right will say, yeah, but you're betraying everyone, and, you know, this is sort of open borders madness. And I think it's because, no, isn't there this perception with people? There's bad migration, there's good migration. And so just as one might then say, hang on, you know, but if you close the borders, rather, the NHS will collapse and all sorts of public services will go under, in a sense, you know, because we rely on them. It sounds too much like moralising, in a sense, when they probably know someone who lost their job, perhaps, you know, to sort of cheap labour, in a sense. How do you moderate? How do you sort of talk? So how do you bridge the divide?
I think it is very polarised, you know, having the symbolic, you know, do you like change or do you fear change? You actually get to the so what should we do now? People feel they haven't had a voice, they haven't had choices, and they see it as a reset moment and they'll expect something to change. I would like to see that as an opportunity to rebuild that confidence in the contribution that immigration makes by really taking seriously that desire to have some choice and some change. So if we now say, oh, because, you know, the banks want the single market, actually, like it or lump it anyway, nothing's going to change, I think we'll see the frustration bubble up again. If you go through the choices people want to make, the question is it control and choice, or is it a crackdown and much less of everything? People don't want to cut skilled immigration. They don't want to cut student immigration at all, and Theresa May sort of felt they did, I think, which was odd. They do want to reduce the pace of low-skilled immigration, and yet they know that care homes need staff and fruit needs picking, so they want to have a way to manage that, and they want to manage the impacts better. And there's a lot of convergence on that that will frustrate people who want to be proved right. Your sort of strongest Liberal Democrats and your UKIPers want the other side to admit that they were wrong about everything, but actually across the middle of the referendum, among the 16 and 17 million, actually the sort of 15 million in the middle kind of see it as a chance to strike the balance. There are pressures of immigration, there are gains of immigration, we could keep those gains, and actually the treatment of the Europeans here is the first sort of big genuinely ethical judgment as well as practical judgment of how we do that, and that turns out to be something on which, you know, 84% of us agree rather than 48%.
Interesting. Well, I guess slowly but surely we will hopefully find that sort of moderate balance as the Brexit negotiations go on, although I'm afraid it's sort of, I have to draw this debate to a close, as fascinating as it has been. So thank you so much, Sundar Katwala of the British Future Think Tank, and Carl Sharo, so the Middle East commentator. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And so, coming up next, I'll be speaking to MEP David Campbell-Bannerman. But first, our reporters took to the streets of Islington, where FUBAR Radio is based, to ask what the general public think of immigration. Now, I think it's safe to say this poll might be indicative of Islington, but perhaps not the rest of the country.
I think it's a very tricky topic. I think that there's a lot of issues around it that aren't fully understood, and I think that there's a lot of positives and a lot of negatives to immigration. But I think as a voter, I'm assuming this is to do with the most recent election, I think it's a very difficult issue to see the kind of the raw facts of, and I think the media does a very bad job of educating most people about the pros and cons of the issue.
I don't know the details of the policy enough to comment on that, really. I know we need immigration for economic reasons. I live in London, so I enjoy the multicultural aspect of it. I'm also aware that there are parts of the country where people are terrified of immigration and terrified of people who don't look like them or sound like them, but I've lived in London for 20 odd years, so I'm perfectly comfortable with it.
I think the more we can come and go, the better. I think it's great that people come from all over the world to the UK.
I've got lots of friends who come from other countries. I'm the daughter of an immigrant, and my friends who are here do amazing jobs in the public sector and private sector, and we're in London. They bring diversity and make London an altogether exciting and interesting place to live.
I'm an immigrant, so I think it's positive. I think it brings a lot more interest and positive change to all of us, whether where we're coming from or the effects that we have on the people when we arrive. So things like pubs changing to gastropubs, going from just tea and coffee to cappuccino, white bread to baguette. So it's been a real nice cultural mix, languages, food, music. So I think it's really positive.
I'm pretty much clear on this. I believe that London is a place which is really rich in diversity, and if we curb immigration, we stand to lose our essence. So really, the more the merrier.
FUBAR Radio presents.
FUBAR Radio presents
Politics on FUBAR.
Welcome back to Politics on FUBAR. It's Asa Bennett here, and I've got the pleasure to have David Campbell-Bannerman on the line. Hello.
Hi, Asa. How are you doing?
Wonderful to hear from you now. Thank you much. I was in the middle of embodying what people were sort of talk about if they were sort of hard border fans who wanted us to clamp down immigration. So I can't resist asking, actually, then, you know, as a seasoned Brexiteer who is excited now to be losing his job in 2 years' time,
yes,
you know,
yes.
Britain getting its independence, do you feel, I mean, do you want even Britain to have immigration go down or up?
Oh, I want it to go down, definitely. It's what the British people want.
Hmm.
It's not. It's important to understand, you know, immigration is a good thing. We're not really arguing that point. But you do need to control the numbers. I mean, two reports just this week, where we had the population rise of over 500,000 in the last year. And 1 in 10 people in this country are now foreign. Now, you know, as I said, I welcome a lot of that, but it's about numbers. It's about managing the numbers. It's a management thing, not a sort of trying to bring an end to immigration. And I think people really want to see that because our population is rising at a huge rate. And we can't provide enough schools or hospitals or roads to meet that need.
But then some of your colleagues, like Daniel Hannan, he doesn't mind actually if it goes up instead.
Well, Dan has a different view. He's more of an economic liberal than I am. You know, I understand the reality of that. But
doesn't
the problem
it
is
mean
when
one of you is going to be very unhappy in 2 years' time?
Well, I think Dan is pretty happy as I am with Brexit. This is an area different in terms of the scale of immigration. I do think it needs management and control. I mean, if we lived in a sort of perfect world where all the economies around the world were about the same, you wouldn't have the issue. And in fact, when we first started in the EEC with six nations, and it went from there, there wasn't really much of an issue. But since 2004, our population has gone up about 7 million. And this has created real pressure on our public services, particularly London and the South East. And I think it has become a massive issue. You know, we cannot build a Birmingham for every 2 years. That's the rate we're going. We're having to build a house for an immigrant every 5 minutes. And I think the British people just say, look, hang on a minute. You know, we do like immigration, but we want to manage the numbers.
But then in terms of what Brexit can do to answer that, now as someone who sort of went from the Conservatives to UKIP and back again, you'd understand better than many sort of what led people, you know, from supporting the Conservatives to be disaffected, annoyed, and then to, I know that you returned because you thought that, right, you know, we're serious about getting a referendum, the Conservatives are the best bet of getting Britain out of the European Union. However, your old colleagues in UKIP, what's left of it, the sort of the husk that remains these days, they insist actually that, you know, they will come back with a vengeance because there's going to be betrayal, there's going to be fudge, compromise, and that means you voters and people like you may well come back. Do you think they're right?
Well, it's possible. I think, though, the future of UKIP is to take Labour voters and working class.
So it's possible there'll be betrayal and fudge, you're saying?
Well, no, I'm not saying that, but I think that's the only future for UKIP. I don't think there's going to be betrayal and fudge. I mean, I think there will be a vigorous debate on the type of immigration policy we're going to put forward. Obviously, there's an immigration bill, there's one of the 8 Brexit bills. That will give a bit more detail, but it's probably more of a framework. I mean, all we're really saying is that let's have a similar immigration system to Australia or Canada or United States, which obviously they all welcome immigrants coming into the nation, but they do manage the numbers far better than we do. We have an opportunity post-Brexit. I mean, to date, we've only been able to control half our immigration, so we've been over tough on Indian students or Australians or Canadians. You know, we can rebalance our immigration system, so it's actually fairer to non-EU.
But then that's the goal, of course. But then in terms of getting there and getting everything, sort of having a big, audacious, you know, good Brexit deal, it's sort of curious, because everyone seems to... There's a whole narrative of who has the cards, who has the better hand, you know, what can we trade away, in a sense. Now, Theresa May, obviously, I'm sure you've studied the Lancaster House speech, you know, as well.
Yeah.
There was a lovely line in there where she said, sort of, this will require creative thinking on both sides. You know, there will be... compromise is necessary. Yeah. So, and obviously you're saying it is possible that there'll be sort of compromise that leads to sort of disaffected people, you know, running off. What do you think Britain would have to or may end up having to trade away?
Well, I think it's worth saying that, look, we have had immigration under control in the past. In the 1990s, it was under control. It wasn't really an issue. And what we're saying is let's get back to those kind of levels.
What will Britain trade away for a good Brexit?
Well, I don't think we'll have to trade away. Look, we're taking
Theresa May says she's ready to. She's ready.
Brexit. Well, there's negotiations will go on, but I mean, you know, we are being a sovereign, independent nation, and a lot of this actually isn't relevant to the Brexit talks. Then it is when it comes to EU citizens and their rights, etc. And I welcome the generous package we've offered on that. But, you know, a lot of this is about, well, you know, who do we let in? What skills shortages are there?
But do you think the trade away will come in the form of money? People? We'll just have to pay them. We'll have to cross their hands with silver.
I don't think there's any. Look, you know, they want access to our market. We are their largest trading customer. We have to stop talking ourselves down that, you know, they're going to do us a big favor. You don't deal that way. What you're going to say is, look, the EU wants access to our markets. We're the fifth largest economy in the world. We're the largest trading partner. They want to come and study in Britain, etc. So, look, let's do a deal that works both ways. And, you know, I want the EU to get a good deal as well. You know, we've got to be friends and neighbours. But I don't think, you know, throwing cash around is the right way. I mean, how much are they going to pay for our market, for access to our market, if you get into that?
We'll have to see. Although I'm afraid I might have to butt in there, because I would love to obviously talk to you for as long as practically the Brexit negotiations are going on, but I'm afraid I have to wind up because the show is nearing its end. So, David Gemmell-Bankman, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much.
Till next time.
I'll see you from here.
Bye now. And so, yes, that was DCB, as he's known in the European Parliament. And so in the meantime, another acronym of sorts I thought present, you know, in order to wind things up, there's no finer way to do so than with MIA and the song Borders. So thank you very much for listening. And to play us out, here we are.
Freedom, I don't need them. Where's your freedom? This one needs a brand new freedom. Weed and the key, weed and the key into life. Let's beat them. Weed them smartphones, don't beat them. Do system. Yeah, fuck them when we say we're not with them. We solid and we don't need to kick them. This is no Southeast and Western. Yeah, guns, close doors to the system. Yeah, fuck them when we say we're not with them. We solid and we don't need to kick them. This is no Southeast and Western.
This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details.